Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
Hi, this is John Weir, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
So a huge thank you to John Weir for introducing the 132nd and final edition of the Tennis Podcast in 2019. John is one of our biggest backers, has been over the last couple of years with his wife Leah. We're hugely grateful to them for their support, as we are to all of you who've pitched into our Kickstarter to crowdfund 2020. We've had more than 70% success so far in trying to fund next year. Still some way to go for us, but we can't thank you enough. It really has been incredible to see the reaction. More than 800 people, as I speak to you, have got behind the show and contributed at various different levels. And you can continue to do so. If you want to go to Kickstarter.com, search Tennis Podcast 2020, and you'll be able to find us there. Or we have the link as well in our show notes on your phone right now. If you want to just scroll down and have a look on there, you can back us to as much or as little as you've deem fit. I should say as well, a bit of news since last week, our accreditations for Catherine and Matt have both been confirmed for the Australian Open, as have their visas. So we are going, and we can't wait to bring you daily editions of the Tennis Podcast in 2020, starting with the Australian Open, of course. We've had a FaceTime chat, a meeting a few days ago. The ideas are flying around between the three of us at the moment, and we can't wait to get started. A little break after this show, but yeah, Christmas, New Year, then let's get started. Anyway, first of all, though, our final edition of 2020 is a big interview, and it is with Marcus Baghdatis, who called time on his career earlier on this year. And whenever I think of the Australian Open of 2006, I think of Marcus, probably more so than Roger Federer, who actually won the title, probably more so than Amélie Mauresmo, even though she won her first ever Grand Slam singles title by beating Justine Henin, who retired in the final. I feel a bit bad about that, but that's just the way it is. Baghdatis was the defining picture, image of that particular tournament. And when I saw him at the O2 a few weeks ago, which is where we conducted this interview, he was covering the ATP finals as a commentator, and he was doing so for Greek television. Obviously, Stefanos Tsitsipas, a huge part of that tournament. And I saw Marcus walking around. I'd known him over the last 15 years when he'd been around on the tennis circuit, but only very vaguely. I'd only known him from afar. I'd interviewed him once or twice for BBC Radio, said hello, you know, if he passed in the corridor, but we didn't know each other particularly. But what really struck me when I saw him at the O2 was just how warm he was, not just to me, but to pretty much everybody he came into contact with. You know, a lot of players retire and they may join the media. They might not necessarily hang out with the media or go in the media restaurant or in the media workroom. And he did. And he seemed to think nothing of that, which is kind of how I feel it should be. Why shouldn't you be able to be open with people, and as long as they treat you decently as well, give them the same back? But the way he behaved really made me feel actually he wouldn't mind an approach from somebody you didn't know that well asking for an interview, and that's exactly what I did. And he couldn't have been more accommodating and helpful to make time for it. We met on the final day of the tournament when Tsitsipas was about to take on Dominic Thiem in the final. We met shortly before that. We had some crowd noise to deal with, and so you know, we were in the O2, so you have a few bits of noise, but we tried to make it the very best we could. We stopped halfway through in order to move and find a better place to do the interview. But I think the results, you will probably agree, are really worth it. He's just such an interesting guy to listen to. I should also say that since we spoke, the news has come out that Elena Svitolina has hired Marcus as her coach, or at least join her coaching team alongside Andrew Bettels. Now, I knew this was coming because just as I pressed stop on the recorder of our interview, Marcus told me that he was going to be back in tennis very soon coaching Elena Svitolina, but he asked me not to let on because it hadn't been announced yet. And, well, I talked to him about it off air. I'll tell you about all that after you listen to this interview, but obviously, you know, I kept my promise. And it's an interesting development. I'll tell you about it more in a moment. But first of all, here's the conversation with Marcus Baghdatis. Marcus, it's so lovely to see you here at the O2 Arena where we're sitting right now, overlooking the court on which you stood yesterday with all of your contemporaries, people that you played for many, many years with, all of you who'd had long, illustrious, incredibly detailed and passionate careers, and all of you were calling the end.
The end, yes. I mean, first of all, I mean, they're my friends. I mean, it's funny because yesterday we had some chats and it's the first time, you know, with most of the people I had chats about their lives, but with some not, you know, and, you know, to sit down with them on the boat and chat about other things in a more relaxed way and, you know, just talk about life and how he played and how, you know, about his career and, you know, it's a different kind of talk you have with people, and I think I find it interesting and fun, and I think we can even get closer with the ex-players because of that. You know, yeah. There's no more the competition that we used to have, and you can talk about different things about and wish them different nice things about their life, and it's really interesting and very, very beautiful to have experienced.
Yeah. You say we could talk about different things, and we really could. I mean, we could spend hours talking about the last 20 years of your life, but we've only got a certain amount of time because they're going to start the finals day here and the noise will start. And I want to talk to you about the first time. I mean, I saw you play as a junior.
Yes.
But I remember 2006, as I'm sure you do, more than anything, really. And just that Australian Open to start with, because when we arrived in Australia, nobody was talking about Marcus Baghdatis.
Yes.
But everybody was when they left.
Yes. No, for sure. I mean, that was the highlight of my career. A lot of people start talking about me back then. I mean, and I like it when you remind it to me, because that's the emotions I dream of having as a young kid, you know. And it's the connection that I had with the fans, with the people, and I think that's the best gift anybody can ask for, you know, as a young kid. And to be able to experience that was unbelievable at that level, you know, at that point, at that emotional place, you know, to have been able to be there. It was something very special for me in my life. Of course, everybody talks about that, but I had other great matches or tournaments before that and after that. But, you know, to the people's eyes to the people's eyes, that was the big moment with my name in it. So yeah, I mean, but I had other great moments. Like you said, it's 20 years career. It's not just one Grand Slam.
We'll talk about some of those moments as well in this podcast. But when I was there in 06, I remember you beat Roddick.
Yes.
I remember you beat Ivan Ljubicic, incredibly passionate crowds on both sides.
Yes.
And then you beat David Nalbandian. And I was watching some of the highlights back today to remind myself of that match. I commentated on that match for the BBC radio team at the time. And the shock in all of our voices as you were doing what you were doing, how did it happen? How did this run happen? Because I know you'd had good results before, but it's still a big difference to what you ended up going on to do.
Yes, definitely, and I think in people's eyes, it's the talent, it's the hard work. Of course, that's part of it, but I think the love and the heart and the passion of the sport is what made me achieve what I achieved that tournament. I think I was fearless. I had a dream, was to win a Grand Slam. I got so close to that dream, and yeah, I mean, it's just amazing to remind me of that. But I think I achieved because of the heart I had. I gave it all out there in every single match I played, especially the match against Nalbandian. I was 2 sets to love down, and I found the extra energy, power, will, whatever you can call it, to come back and use the crowd and make it like a roller coaster match. You know, he was up, then I was up, then he went back up, but I was 2 love up, then he went 4-2 up in the fifth, and then came back. And also, I remember so well when I was serving for the match, there was this rain
and
coming.
You put your hands out wide, yes, and looked up into the sky.
And you know what I said exactly? I remember my exact words, because I had so many challenges in my life. And I told whoever's up there, thank you for giving me this extra challenge, you know, that I have to get through it, and I will get through it. And I remember very well going back into the locker rooms after that rain delay, and I sat on the bike to keep moving my legs, you know, because if you stop at that moment moving, I think you start cramping, you start feeling a lot of stiffness on your legs and on your body. And my coach came in, and I told him, you know, I don't know what to do. You know, I was a bit lost, and he told me, continue what you're doing, and he should be worried. And that gave me so much freedom and confidence. That was amazing, and that helped me get through that game and win the match and have the most unbelievable feeling I ever had on a tennis court.
And I remember you mentioned the crowd. You used the crowd. I don't think anywhere has seen a crowd like that before. I mean, yes, in Davis Cup, but
yes.
I mean, your fans in Australia, and you talk about Australia and the love that you feel and the way that inspired you, and a lot of your moments came at the Australian Open, but that crowd was extraordinary. And I remember you would sort of meet them afterwards as well, wouldn't you?
Yes, because they gave me so much joy, so much emotions on the court. And I'm a person that I believe that it's good to give back. You know, it's not only taking, it's giving also. And I learned that, I guess, from my mom, I guess, because she's kind of that person. She gave a lot to families in Cyprus before I became somebody. And she taught me that way. And I think I have that from my mom, and a very emotional person. And I like to connect with people. I like to give back. I like to receive also, which is normal. It's a give and take thing. But, you know, for me, what I take is I learn from people. I learn from discussions. I learn from talking to different kind of people. And that's a great gift to have.
You played Roger Federer in the final, who was at the time... He felt unbeatable. He was losing 5 matches a year at that point, and you led him by a set and a break.
And double break point at 2-love, 15-40 on his serve. I remember very well. And sometimes I don't regret, but I wish I had found a way to win, because I could have felt even an much more extraordinary emotion. But yes, I mean, Roger, I was unfortunate, I think, in that way, to have Roger at that time. You know, I think if if you know, it was maybe a less experienced Roger. You understand what I'm trying? I would maybe find a way to win, but he knew how to deal with these moments, and he dealt it better than me. And it was unfortunate for me, but...
Well, how did you go up a set and a break, and how did it change?
Okay. When I lost to him earlier in Doha that year, so we're talking about 2 weeks beforehand, 6-4, 6-4, and I kind of saw what I need to do, and I told my coach, next time I play him, I'm going to beat him. So I went in the match with a clear mind, and the... My goal, my objective on that match was to aggress him as much as possible. So I started very aggressive, being patient on the points that it's important to be patient. For example, I know that Roger on a 30-all, he's more, when it's tight, you know, he's more able to make a mistake than when he's up.
Yeah.
So... was to take Roger at that point at a 30-all stage and then start to be very consistent then, you know, not to give him rhythm at that point, and then when it comes to that point to start, you know, make him play more and make him try to do something. And then honestly, the big difference was at 6-5 for Roger in the second set, where I was serving and I was 40 love up on my serve. I had a 3-game point to go to a tiebreak, and I saw me winning, unfortunately. I saw myself winning, and when you get to that stage, I think you hurry, you want it faster.
What did it look like, you winning? What was in your mind?
I realized what's going on.
You realized that... Did you imagine the trophy?
Yes, I realized that where I am, you know, I realize what's going on, with who am I competing, and I made some mistakes on that game. I made 2 double faults, if I remember well, and maybe 3 on that service game. I let him come back, he won the set, and from that moment I was mentally killed. I saw in a few seconds that I am about to win, and then everything disappeared. And everything went after so fast. I couldn't handle the pressure. I mean, to be honest, which that is the key of winning those matches.
And probably normal.
You can call it normal. And yeah, and that was it. I mean, that was it. And
what was life like for you around that point? Because I remember seeing a tweet from Stefanos Tsitsipas from Australia after he reached the semifinals, and he said, "Melbourne, I love you, but please, for one day, just leave me alone."
Yeah.
And I just wondered what it was like for you at that point.
I was loving it, for sure. I mean, I was loving it. I couldn't ask them to leave them alone because I put them in that situation. So, I mean... it's a nice feeling. I think you should embrace it, live it, and I mean, live with it as a proud moment, and you know, try to live it as much as possible. You know, be in it as much as possible.
It was an incredible year, 2006. The rest of it, because you went all the way to the semifinals of Wimbledon. You beat Leighton Hewitt, who'd won the title. You beat Andy Murray. I mean,
a young Andy Murray, but he beat Roddick before, the match before.
Very good Andy Murray, and you played Rafael Nadal. Was your tennis at that point the best of your career generally? I know you had the best results of your career, but was that your best tennis that year?
Yes, I think I was fearless, no injuries, I didn't have any injury problems. I mean, yes, I was playing the most aggressive tennis, yes, it was my best tennis, I think.
And you went on to the US Open that year and had that match with Andre Agassi, which I don't think anybody who saw that will ever forget it. Andre wrote about it a lot in his book. He talked about the physical state you were both in the locker room afterwards, and you both looked like you were going to need to be carried out.
he was more in that stage than me, but yeah.
You were cramping.
Yes, I was cramping, yes.
Of course, because the next round he ended up losing to Benjamin Becker. What do you remember from seeing him in the locker room that time?
I mean, Steffi Graf came in and everybody was hugging each other, you know. I mean, I think it was a great match for tennis. Andrei was my idol. I mean, an inspiration to my game and to a lot of kids, I guess, but especially to me. And I watched the first match I ever watched on TV in Cyprus was the final against Ivanisevic in Wimbledon, which he won. I remember, you know, the hats they made with the hair, long hair. I had a bunch of them. I told my godmother to change my name to Agassi. You know, I mean, there was a lot of stuff that that made me love Andre, and I think it was an honor to be able to, let's say, be the loser of his... I mean, being the last match win was against me, so...
And a great match, too.
Yes, yes.
Did you... You said you idolized him. Did you ever copy him at all? Because I always used to look at your game, and it always used to make me think of a young Andre Agassi, the way you struck the ball, the way you moved...
Yes, I copied him not, but when you idolize somebody like that, and you unconsciously you will copy him. So because you learn from him the way he plays, because you look at him and you kind of copy his patterns, not his technique fully, but you know the way he takes it on the rise, the way he hits the ball, and. Yeah, so I can say yes, I copied him unconsciously, yes.
Did you, after 2006, I mean, you had some amazing wins. You beat Roger Federer, you beat Rafael Nadal, you were a factor at big tournaments, but you didn't have as spectacular results as you did in 2006. I know you had a lot of injuries, but what would you put it down to that maybe you didn't reach another Grand Slam final, for instance?
First of all, I think I played in an era where we are talking about three, four guys, maybe five. I mean, let's say if you take out Wawrinka, who won three Grand Slams, and Murray, who won three Grand Slams, the other, how many, 55, whatever, Grand Slams, has gone to three people. I lost many times to Novak in a Grand Slam, where he went on and won it. I lost to Rafa. And I think that's one of the things that also mentally was tough for me, because my dream was to win a Grand Slam. And also the other thing was, at one point where I start having the injuries, I start changing. I changed the way I worked. I tried to spend more time in the gym, get bigger, and that didn't help my game. So, I mean, when I say get bigger, it's stronger.
More muscular.
And it didn't help. I thought at that time that was the best way to improve my injuries, to improve my way of playing. And because I'm a very stubborn guy, I don't, you know, when I see something, I want to do it 100%, and I could hit the wall a lot of times until I realized that it's not. And unfortunately, that was the second and biggest, I think, I cannot say mistake, because it's a decision that I took and I thought
part
was the best. It's part of life. And I didn't do it by... I did it by listening to an ex-8 Grand Slam champion. You understand what I mean? Which was my idol. So
Andre had suggested that maybe you...
I mean, not Andre himself, but his team and everything.
Yeah.
And it kind of... I believed for many years that was the way, and then lately I realized that, no, it's not the way.
What did it change? You trying to be more muscular, what was the problem with that?
More weight, less explosive, less... stiffer... which I was a very relaxed person on court. You know, I was my difference was before I was very explosive, so I would hit a forehand explosively, not with power.
And it
took me back, and I think that was the change of my career. But you know, I don't think it's a regret. You know, I think I learned from it. I think I didn't have maybe some people in my own country which I could trust, you know, that went through this experience that could help me, that I could have discussions with. And I mean, that's about it. You know, it's nothing too complicated. It's very simple. I took my decisions. It didn't go the way I wanted. You can say I was unlucky. You can say I did the wrong decisions. You can say it's a mistake. You can say whatever you want. But I feel that that was a part of my life, and I'm grateful still that I still had great moments. You know,
you sure did.
And that's what stays with me. And I loved every moment of it, even if there were some tough moments. There were some moments where you had so many doubts. I cannot call it depression, but you know, loneliness, you know, you had that.
Because of tour life or?
Because of tour life, because of traveling, because of just looking at a tennis ball, because of leaving home when I was 14 to achieve my dream without having parents that knew what is tennis, what is going on.
I read some quotes from your dad that when you went, obviously he said when you got to the final, it kind of was giving something back because he felt like he'd lost you as a teenager for a period of time.
Yeah, I spoke a lot with my father, you know, since I had kids, and you know, he knows that he took a decision for me. He doesn't regret it, but he lost a kid, you know, and I mean a kid. He lost his son at a very young age. The relationship with the son, and you know, we had a blank moment with my parents, with my life, with my, you know, with my family. There was a blank moment, you know, where we were all lost in it. And but you know, we all learned from it. We all went through it together. We had lots of chats, and you know, like I think he took the right decision, because he explained to me from a very young age to take responsibility of my life, and that's why today I have the life I have, with three beautiful kids, with a lovely wife. There is so much positive out of what decision he took. It's not just about tennis. It's about having a great life. And he teach me that, you know, there is only plan A, there is no plan B, and that's why I achieved, because I didn't have a plan B. If I had a plan B, I would always find excuses and go through plan B, and you know, and being, and I think I achieved what I achieved because of my plan A, because I had no other choice. There was just one way, and I dealt with it as good as I can.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com tennisfootball.com/host.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Well, Marcus and I have just moved out the O2 Arena because they've decided to put the music on, and we want to just finish this chat in the nicest possible circumstances. I mean, it's an amazing story. I mean, and I'm sure so many tennis players go through this situation with their families of when and how to try to make it. And obviously yours is more extreme because you were from a country that didn't have a tennis infrastructure and background. I mean, it is pretty extraordinary that you did what you did and you managed to achieve all you did.
Thank you. Yes, for sure. I mean, I achieved part of my dream. I mean, my dream was really to win a Grand Slam and be number one in the world and have, you know, more titles than I have. But I know where I come from. I know what I've done to be able to be here, and to me, yes, it's special. It's something special. I think every player goes through his difficulties. Every difficulty is for me equal because it's a difficulty, and you know, some people can perform better, some people not, and that's the way life is, you know, and I think you have to accept it. You have to learn from the lessons, because for me, I don't call them losses, it's lessons. You learn from them and try not to do the same mistakes twice, because I've learned that from a very young age when I went to Paris. It's my first coach in Paris. The first word he told me is, you can do a mistake, but don't do it twice because it means you're stupid. And that was pretty clear, you know, like not to do the same mistake on court, off court, wherever, in life in general, not to do it twice. So my goal is to try and do that. Once you realize your mistake, not to do it again, or help others not to do it. And that's the best lesson I think I ever learned.
Do you ever watch back matches of yours or moments from your career? I mean, you mentioned you've got three young kids now as well. I mean, it's a lifetime of memories.
Yes, I mean, I don't. I have a problem with that, and I think it didn't help me throughout my career. Now that I think about it, I never liked watching myself.
Why is that?
I don't know. I never liked, maybe lack of some confidence, maybe, I don't know. I all the time was very, because I'm a perfectionist and very stubborn, I didn't like it. I kind of every time saw something wrong about me, and I couldn't take it. I didn't want to watch it. Maybe it would help me a bit if I watched more matches of me, of how to deal with players, but I couldn't. I just couldn't, and yeah.
It's very interesting.
Yes, it is. And for me, life is all about being happy. Honestly, it's being happy, have the self-discipline that you need to have to be able to achieve your goals. But being happy, being with a smile, being waking up every morning and want to do the things that you're doing. And I lost that a bit in the middle of my career. And I... But I found another way, sorry, by my family, by doing a family which I always had, I always wanted to have, because I left home very young and I wanted to build a family of my own and be close to, you know, be loved in a way. And you know, I found my happiness, which is for me the most important thing in life.
Yeah. A couple of other memories. 4:34 a.m. in Australia, you and Leighton Hewitt.
Yes.
I mean, what do you remember of finishing a match at 4:34 a.m.?
I remember really going into the hotel, getting into the elevator and seeing other players going for breakfast. I mean, that's ridiculous. Like, and they saw me and they told me, what, you went to early practice? And I said, no, we just finished, because some people were sleeping, you know, they didn't stay up and some players were sleeping. So they were all shocked. And I remember that very, I have that image in my mind whenever we talk about that match.
It's bizarre.
Yeah, it's bizarre. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing more you can say. Yeah, it's bizarre finishing and getting to the hotel at 7 a.m. I think it's very bizarre, yes.
The other question that our listeners would not forgive us if we didn't ask is the four rackets that you smashed on the court that day. Also in Australia. Everything seemed to happen to you in Australia, which I watched that back again earlier today. And, I mean, I felt very sorry for you in the moment. You know, you're so frustrated. You're playing Stan Wawrinka. And, well, what were your memories of it? Because, I mean, we often see players smash rackets, but, I mean, to sit there and smash four is quite a lot.
I lost it. I mean, I lost it completely. There is no explanation. And I said it before. It's one thing. Honestly, I regret it because I think that's not the image that you give out to young kids that idolize you or that want to be a professional tennis player and watch that match. But yeah, I mean, it's at least it was funny in some way, you know. But really, that moment, I wasn't thinking straight. I completely went tactically. I wasn't doing the right thing, and I knew it from the beginning of the match. But I was keeping on doing it, and at one moment I went nuts with myself, but it's something that I'm not proud of.
I mean, there was a moment at the end where the crowd actually seemed to cheer and you seemed to smile as if you'd suddenly thought, oh, dear.
No, it's like I realized what I've done. The crowd was asking for one more and I gave it to them for one more. At least it went out in a funny way, you know. Yeah. Like, but really, I am not proud of that moment.
Okay.
But it's part of my life. It's something, it's a mistake, or you can call it whatever, that I've done.
Yeah,
and I take it in a positive way, and you know, like I try to explain to every kid, because there is a lot of people that tell, this is a guy who broke four rackets, and I'm like, yeah, but you know, I'm not that guy. You know, I was that guy for a second or two.
Who was the toughest opponent you faced?
Djokovic. For me, couldn't find the solution against him. I was very close many times, but he always found a way, in a way that I always felt that he was on top of me. I always felt that. But with Rafa, no. With Roger, not. Because with Roger and Rafa, I all the time felt I had that chance. I have him. You know, I had him with Djokovic. I go out of the match and say, I don't have him, you know? He was control of the matches. Even if it's at 5-5 in the fifth, I felt he was in control. And with the others, I felt that I was in control, but I didn't make it. You understand what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, no, I totally understand. And every player, I think, has somebody, don't they?
Yeah.
Even you think about Federer with Nadal early in the career. He was the man that caused him so many problems. Just a couple of final points, Marcus. I mentioned Stefanos Tsitsipas, who is somebody that is often kind of compared to you because of the effect you have in that part of the world. And I know you know him pretty well. What do you think of Stefanos as a player and as a person?
As a person, as a guy, the guy for me is a genius. He doesn't think like us in a way that he can analyze things in a different way. I see a bit of Roger in him, in his game, and in his mind. When I say mind, on the court is the way he analyzes the matches. Not a lot of players can come out after a match and analyze so well. And that's a very strong advantage that he has. That's one thing. He has a complete game. I think he has very small things to improve. Maybe he slice a bit, his return, make more balls after a first serve. And his self-discipline and determination. I mean, he's at the level of Djokovic for me. And that's why he, and at a very young age, and he can still improve that. And that's why for me he's where he is.
Do you think he's going to be the next one to join these guys?
I think he's the only one with team that have that mentality. And when I say that mentality, to keep on winning slams throughout the years. For me, yes, I can say he's more complete than anybody else. And he's a special kid. He's really a special kid. I spent some time with him last year when he came to Holidays in Cyprus, a bit more to talk about, tennis. I think he needs also to improve his out-of-the-court life.
In what way?
More friends, more relaxed, to have a life outside court, because at one point it can catch you, it can catch you and it can, be a difficult moment, and I think he needs to
sort of overwhelm you almost, because tennis is so big for him, isn't it?
Yes, he doesn't think about anything else. It's tennis and nothing else, which is an unbelievable thing. But he doesn't think like us, I give you an example. If he wins today, what would most people do? It's the end of the year, very important. You go have a dinner, you drink a bit, you enjoy.
Sure.
He would maybe eat in the players' lounge and go sleep. It's a small example, He doesn't think, he doesn't have this need that other people have.
He went on vacation, he went on vacation on his own.
Yes.
And he just was with nobody. He didn't want to see anybody for 10 days.
I mean, that's a quality to have, not to have the need of other people, of things. It's, for me, it's a big quality. You understand what I mean?
Sure.
Because I don't know, some people, I'm just saying, a 21-year-old, he wants to have a girlfriend or do something which is normal in life. And if you want it and you don't have it, it's not good. You understand?
Sure.
But he doesn't maybe want it. It's just an example, I'm not saying.
Yeah.
He doesn't even want it, so he doesn't have this disappointment or that he doesn't have it. And I think it's an unbelievable quality to have as a professional tennis player.
We always talk on this show as well about how he doesn't seem bothered about fitting in. He doesn't need to be with all the other guys and have their approval. He's happy to be himself.
Yes, and that's a huge quality to have. And I think that's what makes him so special. And it kind of makes his life easier on the court.
Yeah.
And in the tennis world.
Final point, Marcus. We bring it back to the ceremony yesterday, where you were standing with all your colleagues, and your career is now at an end, and there's so many happy memories. What now? How do you feel about life now? And clearly, from the conversation we've had, you have three kids, you have a family, your wife. You seem really happy, which is
yes.
great to
Thank
see.
Thank you.
I have to say.
Yeah.
But what else do you want out of life from now?
I mean, I would like to do things in this sport, you know. Maybe as a tennis coach, I would like to help my federation back home. I have some projects in mind. And I would like to stay in the sport, you know, stay in the sport, give what the sport gave to me, because it gave me something very special. It gave me the life I have today. And I want to give back somehow. I mean, that's the goal. Now, how exactly, I don't know yet. It's maybe you'll see me on tour next year. I don't know. But, you know, I mean, it doesn't only depend on me. It depends on the project and the people that want to work with me. But really, I mean, I want to keep being in this sport. And also, I mean, I spend 3 months with my wife and kids. And I can say it's been a long time, and it's been an unbelievable 3 months of my life, you know, taking them to school, you know, doing some things and then picking them up, doing some lunch, you know, being with them, taking my kids to tennis, playing with my daughter. Tennis. Before that, she didn't want to play. She wants to play only with me. And, you know, it's a very nice feeling, and I want to continue that, and being able at the same time to combine, to find the balance between family and then maybe traveling again, which I think it's a very tough thing. And I have the communication with my wife, and we will decide together, but I think, it's not clear exactly what I want to do, but definitely want to give back to the sport. And, I mean, I spent 16 years. We had an unbelievable ceremony with ATP yesterday. I want to thank them from the bottom of my heart, because it was something very special. It was nothing big, but for me, it was emotional seeing all other players sharing their moments, my moments together in one of the best arenas we ever had our sport played. And thank the ATP for all these years, you know, from the medical, from the tour managers, from the media, from the the marketing, from everything that they have done for me and for all the players, helped us become who we are today, from the conversations, from the discussions, from the fights sometimes. I mean, not fights, but you know, how you call them?
Disagreements.
Yeah. You learn, and they made me become who I am today. They were part of my life. And I'm looking forward to my next step.
It's lovely. Lovely to hear, Marcus.
Thank you.
So happy to see you back here in the tennis world, and whatever you do from here, thank you for the memories, and we wish you the very best of luck for the future.
Thank you so much, Dave. Thank you.
So there's Marcus. Hope you enjoyed that. I've just listened to it again, and I can't really get over how warm he is and how open he is. And when Matt Roberts heard that interview a couple of days ago, first thing he said to me was, I listened to that and I just sort of want the best for him. And I know exactly what he means. He's that kind of fellow. You just hope good things for him, because he kind of gives off that vibe that he's hoping for the best for everybody else, which is a lovely quality, really. I mentioned before the interview started there that he told me about the collaboration with Alina Svitolina that he's about to start in 2020. I was initially fearful, I suppose, that that might mean that Andrew Bettles wasn't going to be part of the team anymore. That's since been confirmed that they're going to work together, because Andrew's clearly done an excellent job with Svitolina so far. And what I said to Marcus, I was kind of curious as to what he felt he could bring to Svitolina's game. And my suspicion was and remains that it might help her to sort of free up. You hear how open Bagdatis is as a character. When he played with just such a joy and he went for it. And I tend to feel like Svitolina tightens and becomes a little bit inhibited in the really big moments against the best players, and they end up taking the initiative from her. So I think Bagdatis might just be able to let the shackles go and produce her very best when it matters most. I mean, at least she can give that a try. She's had a fantastic career already. She's already won the WTA finals. She's reached the final again. But at the Slams, for somebody of her ability, she will feel that there's still more to come. So we'll see. We'll see. But very best of luck to Marcus Bagdatis in the future, no matter what he does. I think he's just a great guy. And I'm really chuffed that he was able to appear with us here on the Tennis Podcast. So that is the final edition of the show for 2019. It is our 8th year in production, our 623rd episode overall. It's something we continue to love to bring to you, and we hope that you're enjoying it as well. And we want to do more than ever in 2020. And to do so, we need to fulfill our Kickstarter, our crowdfunding. We're more than 70% funded so far. But if you want to pitch in, do so. We appreciate it enormously. But regardless, thank you for listening to this. I wish you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And we will be back in a few weeks from now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.